Episode 28, Vanessa Zuise Goddard.
One of my favorite quotes is from Suzuki Roshi, who said, "You are perfect and complete just as you are, and you could use a little work." So perfect and complete is every single one of us. And the work is what we do when we're practicing meditation or yoga, or when we do therapy, anything that we do to get to know ourselves.
You're listening to the Taylor Fit Wellness Podcast, where we explore wellness topics from A to Z so that we can take an active approach to improving our quality of life. Okay, so here we go. I am so happy to have with us here today, Vanessa Zuise Goddard. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm so excited for our conversation. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Frances. I am delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I wonder if you would let us know a little bit more about yourself so our listeners can know who you are and how you came to do what you do.
Sure. So you and I met at Zen Mountain Monastery, right? Yes. Where you brought your kids to Zen Kids.
Loved it.
Running for a while. I went to Zen Mountain Monastery really after college, straight after college. I went while I was still in college, but I became very interested in Zen and very quickly decided that that's what I wanted to do with my life. And I was fortunate enough that I was actually able to do that. So I went to the monastery when I graduated from college and decided to stay. And so I lived there for 23 years and lived the life of a monastic. So I was actually a monk, we called it informally, 14 of those years. And I was doing, you know, full-time Zen training and everything that goes along with it, living in community, of course, learning about Buddhism and Zen, and being able, most importantly, being able to practice it, you know, every day, and then to offer it to other people. And in 2019, beginning of 2019, I left and came here to New York City in Brooklyn, where I've been since then. And so I've been teaching independently. Mm-hmm. And I had taken a little time off. I took a sabbatical and I was working on a book. And so I started really kind of formally teaching again during the pandemic. So right now, my group is all online. I hope eventually to be able to meet in person. But right now, we meet online and do meditation and, you know, different programs together.
What a gift, I think, during this time to be able to have that respite, that place to find peace and stillness. I'm so grateful for that.
Well, you know, I was a little selfish in the beginning. I reached a point last summer when I was really feeling the isolation.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, obviously I was in touch with friends and stuff, but, you know, we had gone through lockdown. We weren't seeing one another. And at a certain point, I thought, okay, I really need this. Yeah. And so I invited a few people to just start sitting, start doing Zazen with me. And then slowly that grew. Mm-hmm. And it has been a refuge for me. Absolutely. I hope that it's been for them as well. It was really wonderful for me to have that touchstone and be with people in that way every week.
Yeah. And for those listeners that are unfamiliar, just a brief description of what is Zazen.
Sure. So Zazen is Zen meditation. It means Zazen means seated meditation. And like many forms of meditation, it uses the breath as the point of focus, at least for a while. There are other things that you work on, work with later on, but you begin really with the breath and with developing concentration and not just concentration. I now, when I speak of Zazen, I speak of it in terms of three aspects. Concentration, which is called the sharpening factor of mind, and is what allows you to put your mind in one point and keep it there, right?
Wow.
Mindfulness is the seeing factor. So it's what tells you what is actually in front of you, your awareness. This is my breath. This is a thought. This is a feeling, etc. And then equanimity, or which is the balancing factor. So I see that as, you know, the quality that keeps your mind stable so that you can in fact see what is going on in it. And so I think of Zazen in very general terms as a combination of these three qualities that you're training yourself, or I should say retraining, because actually all of us know how to focus and how to be quiet and still. And we forget often, you know, as we grow up or as we get busier, you know, we forget. And so I think of Zazen as using these three tools, these three qualities to actually see and be in reality, right? Wow. To actually see things as they are is what we call it in Buddhism. Not what we would like them to be, not our wish for how things should be, but how they actually are.
Sometimes that's really hard to see, though, or want to see, right?
It's very hard. We want to
just cover things up or see things differently, right?
But if you think about it, it's actually harder to pretend that things are otherwise and then live your life, you know, in denial or in ignorance or suppression. And so, yes, seeing reality is very difficult because sometimes things are very painful, or sometimes they're sad, or sometimes they're just, you know, every once in a while, they're horrific. I mean, when you look at our world. So life is not easy. Life as a human being is not easy. At the same time, it is wondrous and incredible and joyful. And so... so it's not that because you start meditating, now everything is going to be a bummer. You're just going to see more of life.
Okay.
Right? You're going to see more of yourself and more of the world, and be able, hopefully, you learn then with time, you, how do I actually work with things in a skillful way?
I'm thinking about the 3 points. Like, just if I'm, let me see if I'm getting the 3 points correctly, and you'll correct me. The first point is concentration. The second point is mindfulness.
Right.
And the third point is equanimity.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Okay. So, you know, what came to mind when you started mentioning that these things are things that we have and that we forget, right? Was when we are little babies, I remember there was this kind of revelation that I had no idea. I started attending, you know, so I have two kids, so they're teenagers now, but when they were babies, I started going to a new mom's luncheon, you know, and the great thing was you actually got to eat, because I was one of those moms that was like, oh, I'll do that later. I'll do that. I just never ate, right? It was like just running around. Right. So I went to the new mom luncheons, and I remember holding, this was my older teen, and I discovered this thing that babies were fascinated by, like, lights. And like there was a place we went that had fans on the ceiling, and they just would be mesmerized by that. And they would just, in that moment, the concentration was there, the mindfulness, because they were just like, wow, like in the moment. And then the equanimity, they were just completely content, because they were just like so enveloped in that moment. And I think as babies, that's one of those things that makes babies and pets, right? Like, so irresistible to just watch, right? Because they're so in the moment, right?
Yes. And I think what is that quality of mind that allows you to stay with something so simple as a fan revolving and not be bored, and not wish that you were somewhere else doing something more interesting, more entertaining? Why don't I pull out my phone?
Oh my God.
And so we have made it harder for ourselves to focus. Yeah.
Oh my God, right?
Because we have very, very low tolerance for boredom, or for quote unquote nothing happening.
Right, right.
And so practicing meditation, really any kind of meditation, goes against the grain of how we are growing up, you know, in our society, and what we're doing with our minds, because of course, you know, we don't think about it, but every time we pick up the phone and we look at it, our mind moves away from whatever else it was engaged with. Yeah. And every time you distract yourself, it's like exercising the opposite muscle, right? So instead of being able to stay in one point and your mind remaining stable, you're mm-hmm. saying, this moment is not interesting enough. Let me reach for something that is going to make it interesting.
Wow.
And then, of course, your tolerance, you get used to that thing, and then mm-hmm. you reach for something else mm-hmm. that is more exciting. And it just keeps going.
It's a never-ending cycle. Exactly. You know, I was having a conversation with a friend just a couple of days ago, and I have this post-it. I'll hold it up for you to see, but I'll just tell everybody what it says. It says, having too many options causes insanity. And this is sort of like where we are. We have these endless options, and the next, what is it, shiny object syndrome? The next object is shinier, and the next thing is more exciting, and it's kind of never ending, right? So if you have someone that you're speaking with that is the completely stuck in shiny object syndrome, like how would the process of coming back to a place of simplicity look like?
I think I would recommend you have to start very slowly, because mm-hmm. what you're doing is you're retraining your mind. You're learning how to use your mind differently and how to simplify. And mm-hmm. that's going to feel boring in the beginning. Mm-hmm. It's going to feel hard. You're going to be restless. And so I would probably say start very, very small. Uh-huh. And slowly build up from there. So maybe you could sit down for a minute and be quiet and just be with your breath. Put the phone in the other room so you have no temptation, you know, to pick it up. And you slowly build up without, in one sense, almost like without even noticing, you know.
Yeah.
Depending, it would depend on the person. There are people who are very gung-ho, you know. If I saw someone really wanted to shift and have that personality, then I might say, okay, let's sit down for 5 minutes or 10 minutes and mm-hmm. then you build up from there. So it really depends. There's some people are going to resist it the way through. And so with them, I would say it's almost like you're tricking yourself into doing something different until it becomes easier.
Yeah. Yeah. When you spoke about that, like just starting small until you don't even know that it's happening. Like it's happening. It reminds me of like when you're a kid and you first learn to ride a bike, you have that moment where you're someone's holding on maybe to the seat and you're helping guide you. And then there's that moment where you find your balance and then you've got it, you know, like.
Exactly. And it's like that. There's going to be the awkwardness mm-hmm. before. Yeah. You're going to feel off balance, or like I said, you're going to feel restless. It's not going to feel like it's working. And mm-hmm. so you also have to be persistent.
Oh, that's a really good question. How do I know it's working?
As you're doing it, I hope you don't.
Okay, good.
Because if you're constantly checking, then you're not really doing meditation.
Mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm.
What you're trying to do is you're trying to get close to, in this case, let's say the experience of your breath. So if mm-hmm. every time, you know, if every few minutes you're stopping to be like, okay, how am I doing?
Yeah.
You know, you're just coming out. You're bringing yourself out of your own meditation.
Yeah.
And so you trust, you know, you say, okay, I'm going to do my best for the next 5 minutes. I'm going to put all of my attention on my breath.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I get distracted, I'm going to see that thought. I'm going to gently set it aside and I'm mm-hmm. going to come back to my breath. And we actually count the breath at the beginning, right? So that can help you to concentrate. And so we say, okay, so if you get distracted, then you just come back to one. In the beginning, you may not get past two.
Yeah.
And that's okay. That has happened to every single person who has ever sat down to meditate.
Yeah.
And then over time, you realize it's getting a little bit easier. The space between thoughts gets a little bit longer. And before you know it, you realize, oh, 15 minutes have gone by and you haven't been distracted. You were able to be with your breath.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like doing any kind of exercise, right? If you start doing yoga and you've never done it before,
yeah,
everything is going to hurt the next day. And the antidote for that is not to stop doing it.
Right.
You do it more.
Do it
so that your muscles become accustomed to it.
Okay. Acclimated, right. Yeah. You get used
to it. And at a
it.
Certain point, it's effortless.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's exactly like that.
So this idea, like when we were speaking before, you mentioned this idea of this meeting place between stillness and movement. Can we speak more about the sort of that meeting place between stillness and movement?
Yes, you know, many years ago, while I was living at the monastery, part of our training there was what's called body practice. Mm-hmm. And it is taking a form of movement as meditation, as another way to study the self, to study who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been running really my whole life. I started running formally when I was about 10.
Uh-huh.
And so it's been almost 40 years now.
Wow.
It's kind of incredible with very short stints where because of an injury, I couldn't do it. But really mm-hmm. the whole time I've been running.
Yes, so I always think about you as the runner, as we say. I'm so impressed by that. Like, I love that. Yeah.
Well, it was also such a perfect compliment for all the hours a day I spent either doing meditation or just sitting at my desk, because my job, really, the whole time, most of the time that I was at the monastery was in an office, and so running was just a wonderful way to have a chance to move. And I do a little bit of yoga as well, which just created a good balance, right, between uh-huh. stillness and movement. And at a certain point, I began to practice running as zazen.
Oh,
I never run with music. I just never liked it.
Yeah.
And being at the monastery, it just felt like a very natural practice to do running as moving zazen. What I call still running.
Oh, I love that. Still running. That's like profound to just hear that, still running, because you are moving so profoundly with your body, running, right? Not just walking, not just, you know, moving slowly, but still running. But then the stillness, is that your mind?
Well, you're bringing the stillness, I would say, not just of your mind, but of your body as well. So, mm-hmm. so if you have some practice in doing seated meditation, is mm-hmm. the question that I always asked myself was, how do I bring the same stillness of my zazen and the same concentration and mindfulness and equanimity, the same sense of presence into running?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How do I bring the stillness into movement? Mm-hmm. Or conversely, how do I move into stillness? Which is not my phrase. I actually borrowed it from a yoga teacher, Eric Schiffman.
Eric Schiffman. Oh my gosh. Exactly. I have the book, Yoga, the Spirit and Practice of Moving into Stillness. It's been one of those great staples. Oh,
exactly.
I love that we have that in common.
I read that book many years ago, yes. And I thought that was such a wonderful phrase.
Yes.
Because, you know, meditation, as wonderful as it is not enough. You know, nobody lives on the meditation cushion. Nobody lives on the yoga mat. You have to bring it into your life for it to actually work, right?
Yeah.
And so, and that is the most challenging thing to do, actually. As challenging as meditation can be, especially in the beginning, it's easy compared to bringing that stillness into your life, into movement.
Yeah.
And so I wanted a way to bring the two together. And I thought, what better way to do it than with a practice, with a movement practice that I've been doing for so long?
Yeah.
Let me see how the two can really complement one another. And my argument is that if you can do that with running, you can do that in other areas of your life.
That makes
sense. You can do that at work. You know, mm-hmm. you can do that as you're raising your family. And of course, you know, each of these things, it gets more complicated because there's many more things to take into consideration and to focus on, et cetera.
Yeah.
So, but that's why you start very simply. You start with no movement, right? You train yourself to sit quietly and to let your mind settle.
Okay.
And then slowly you learn how to bring that into movement. That's why we do walking meditation.
I love the walking meditation. That's so good.
That's why I practice running meditation. And so slowly you're bringing it more and more into the rest of your life, where it actually counts, where it actually is working.
I love that. So you and I know each other like primarily through the Zen Kids program, where the kids will sit for a few minutes. And then I have this wonderful memory of the walking meditation, the way the kids did it, where, you know, they would start off, and this was in the offices at the Zen Mountain Monastery, where there are stairways and there's upstairs office area as well. And so just to watch the kids sort of get up and start walking meditation slowly, right? And then the following the leader through the different office spaces, up the stairs, underneath someone's desk area, around a tree, you know, like around a planter, and then getting faster and faster and faster. And that was a lot of fun for the kids. So I love that with the kids walking meditation. So like for those that wouldn't be familiar with, like, how can you make meditation not be sitting? How could you bring it into walking? How could you bring it into running? What is the process that you would think of in that moment?
Mm-hmm. Well, the main anchor, I would say, for your attention is the breath, right? Because you always have your breath. And so just as you're focusing on it while you're sitting, you focus on it while you're walking or while you're running. Mm-hmm. And so I have a number of practices that I've developed over time to really strengthen, you know, that concentration on the breath as mm-hmm. you're moving. And mm-hmm. so you pair your breathing with your steps, you know, as you're running, or you may even, you know, count your breath. I very much, and I speak of this often, I very much think of the breath as the anchor of my awareness. And so that no matter what is happening, whether I'm still or moving, mm-hmm. whether I'm calm or agitated, anxious, thinking a lot, I can always come back to my breath and mm-hmm. ground myself with it.
That's so great. You always have that with you.
Exactly. So you think of it as the thread that is keeping all of these various points together, from stillness mm-hmm. to movement, or the points in your body or body and mind. You think of it as the thread that keeps your attention together.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me of, there was a point of time I remember speaking with a former yoga student, and we were at, I think, a lunch somewhere, and in conversation, it was a few of us at the table. And what they were speaking of was they had an illness. And in yoga class, there was an exercise where it was like counting your breath, and we used a metronome. Mm-hmm. And just put the metronome on play. And the task was, you know, to inhale for a certain number of counts and exhale for a certain number. And it was individual to the student. So, you know, a general number might be inhale for 4 beats and mm-hmm. exhale for 4 as a starting point. Well, this student happened to have a lot of physical pain, and they found that their breath, when they first started the exercise, was very short. Like, they could not do a 4-second inhale, 4-second exhale, because the metronome was kind of making a sound every second. And so that was very eye-opening for them, because they weren't aware of that until that point. But they gradually were able to lengthen their breath. And there's often this mm-hmm. talk about lengthening the breath as well, and focusing on the exhales mm-hmm. As far as, you know, linking relaxation to the breath as well.
Exactly.
Do you find that in that breath as anchor, do you, once you are aware of the breath, do you have some sort of awareness around specifically like lengthening the breath or lengthening the count, or is there some sort of correlation with the breath in number terms?
If like that? If you're sitting, if you're doing seated meditation, no, you essentially are just observing the breath, following the breath, counting it to help you, you know, stay more focused. But there is no attempt to control or modify your breath in any way. So you're really just being present to it. You're witnessing mm-hmm. your breath. Mm-hmm. And if anything, the practice is to, over time, get closer and closer to the experience of the breath, so you become intimate with it, to the point where at a certain point, you know, there's no Francis following the breath, there is just the breath breathing itself.
Wow.
Which is just one way of saying it. And then, you know, always the danger when I say something like that is then people get really excited and then try to recreate that, which is the surest way of not having it happen.
Uh-oh.
You can't make that happen. The only thing you can do is to keep strengthening that focus, because that's what closes the gap between you and the experience of the breath. So in that respect, you're not doing anything with it other than just being with it.
That's so hard, I think, for people who are used to being doers. They've got to achieve this. They've got to get this goal. And we're so goal oriented in that way. You know, so like an A-type personality might have a real hard time with that. How do I just be, I guess, is the question.
Well, they can focus on, because they're not going to be able to stay on the breath, at least in the beginning, they can focus on the coming back, because you do have to do that. You have to see the thought, set it aside, as opposed to just running with it. You know, you're there. And because, you know, the task is very simple. If you think about it, you're just counting your breath.
Yeah.
Inhale, one. Exhale, two.
Yeah.
Inhale, three, until you get to 10. And then you come back to one. Yeah. It's very simple.
I love that it's
for
simple.
10 out of 10 people at the beginning is going to be incredibly difficult to do.
Yeah. I had the experience of always ending up on 15 somehow or 11,
exactly.
You know, I started on one, and although the instruction is when you get to 10 to, you know, pause and come back to begin at one again, I would be on 11 or 15 and then finally realize, oh, oops, and then come back.
And it's that moment of oops. That's the moment of realization. That's the moment of seeing, right, of mindfulness. Oh, I'm distracted. Okay, set aside the thought and then come back. And you just start over at one. So the doing, which is what builds the concentration, is noticing, first of all, oh, I'm thinking now. I'm no longer on my breath. Or I lost count.
Oh, yeah.
Or I'm thinking about that incredible trip to the Bahamas. I'm not in the room, let alone with my breath. And so you're noticing first and foremost what is happening. And then you're very persistently, very gently, but persistently bringing yourself back to your breath, which is where you said you were going to put your attention. So there's plenty to do. For sure. I don't think us doers have to worry too much. There's not going to be anything to do.
Yeah.
But there is also this element of surrender, of acknowledging that you're not going to be able to control this, that you're probably not going to be able to do this as perfectly as you would like to, and that that's exactly how it's supposed to be. That you're not sitting down in order to count to 10, 15 times. You're sitting down to notice what is happening in your body and mind.
Okay.
That's the most important thing. And the breath is just a vehicle.
It's a vehicle.
Ancient vehicle. Mm-hmm. People have been using the breath as a meditation object probably for 5,000 years or more.
Yeah.
So, but it's really just a vehicle to help you stay present with yourself.
I had this experience, as we say, at the Zen Mountain Monastery, sort of sitting in the meditation hall. When you speak of surrender, this is what is coming up for me. As a newer meditator coming into the space and having sort of the container and the processes that are there, I felt like learning to follow the instructions was one piece of the puzzle. When going from sitting to the standing and then walking meditation was another piece of the puzzle. You know, learning, you know, what the rules are, you know, if you move, if you have the sniffles, like, what do you do? Is it okay? Is it not okay? And this idea of surrender, I think, applies to every different personality type, because I imagine, you know, if I am in there and I'm like wondering, like, am I doing it right? Am I doing it right? then that's kind of my own stuff coming up, mm-hmm. you know, and if I misstep with regard to turning the wrong way when it comes to walking meditation, then it's like, oh, I got to correct myself. And then the inner dialogue that happens, I think for each person, they're going to have a different looking surrender. Mm-hmm. You know, for an A-type person, they might be like, okay, I'm going to get this. And perhaps they might be like the best student, you know, in the space, or, you know, for someone who's a little unsure, that might be what comes up for them. Does that seem like it would be different for people in that way, the surrender?
Yes, I think if you think about it as surrendering to reality, mm. then anything that we fight about reality is going to come up, right?
Wow.
And so that's, again, why the breath is not only an anchor, it can also be a mirror. And, you know, training at a place like the monastery, you know, because it's formal and because there's a whole community of people and there are certain rules, certain ways of how you do things, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes that can make people a little nervous. But mm-hmm. I always spoke of it as, you know, think of it as a container.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
We wanted to create a container in the Zendo, the meditation hall, that was mm-hmm. such that people could feel completely safe and completely mm-hmm. held to be sitting there with their eyes almost closed,
yeah.
and not have to worry about anything.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
They don't have to worry about the time. They don't have to worry about the lights. They don't have to mm-hmm. worry about the temperature. They don't have to worry about what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. If somebody is not feeling well, somebody else takes care of them. So that your whole occupation is to just be with your breath, right? Yeah. To be with your body and to be with your mind.
Yeah.
And so there's the aspect of there being discipline and there being the rules, but they really are just for the purpose of creating a space where you can completely focus, where you yeah. can completely turn inward, is what we would call it. Now, when you're at home, you want to actually create the same space. And it's not that you have to make rules for yourself. It's just that, you know, anybody who's raised kids yeah. knows that discipline creates a container for kids and creates a certain predictability. So they know what's going to happen next. So they don't have to worry.
Right.
And there's less anxiety. So there's, you know, not too much. Mm-hmm. It's harsh. And not too little that the whole thing just breaks apart.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you'll find that every aspect really of spiritual practice has those two components of relaxation and, let's call it, alertness. You know, there has to be some effort. You can't just be completely, you can't completely surrender and not do anything, because then nothing will happen.
Yeah.
So there's always this very interesting, I find, dynamic between doing enough and not doing too much. And the only way to learn how to do that is you have to keep doing it.
Keep doing it.
You learn it over time. In the beginning, most of us do too much, mm-hmm. especially if you're really interested in it. You know, you want to learn, you want to get better at it. Most of us do too much,
yeah.
especially in our culture, right?
Yeah.
And so then you have to learn with time, okay, how do I relax into this? How do I not do so much? How do I let my breath do what it does? I don't have to keep forcing it. I don't have to keep watching it. I just have to be there mm-hmm. with it.
What comes to mind as we're speaking about this in the moment is this idea that if there is a person who is like a new meditator, and then there's a person who is an experienced meditator that have been doing it for a very long time, I imagine that the new student might think, oh, well, if I do this, then I will just have, as I continue and I've done it over time, it will just be much more peaceful all the time. I think that's not really the case. Like, the long time meditator still has their ups and downs. Yes.
Yes, absolutely. I'm sorry to give the bad news that no, you don't reach a point where then everything is just calm, like a crystal pool. And why would you want that anyway?
Right. Well, I'm thinking the ocean analogy comes up a little bit. There are right. still moments, and then there are moments of more movement, and it will ebb and flow just like the wind changes. That's life. It's going to keep, the wind's going to keep blowing. It's never going to stop completely.
Exactly. And you wouldn't want it to, because that's, you know, that's where life is happening. And so the ocean analogy is an excellent analogy. So if you think of the ocean as your mind, again, as your awareness, and you think of yourself as a boat, right? Like a vessel. Yeah. And the breath is your anchor. And you're anchored, the anchor is all the way down at the bottom of the ocean, where it's still, where it's still and stable. It's quiet and it's dark, so there's not too much, you know, going on to distract you.
Yeah.
On the surface, there's the winds going back and forth. And there's actually, in Buddhism, we say this, there's eight worldly winds: pain and pleasure, loss and gain, fame and disrepute, and I always forget the last one, praise and blame.
Wow.
And all of us swing from one end to the other. You know, we look for pleasure, we avoid pain.
Yeah.
We want fame, recognition of some sort. We do not want to be put down or criticized.
No. Mm-mm.
We want to be praised. We definitely don't want to be blamed.
No.
And so we're constantly swinging, you know, so the wind comes and somebody reads my book and they say they loved it. And I feel really good and I feel really proud of myself. And then, I don't know, I go on Amazon and I see somebody panned it. And now I feel really depressed. Right? Okay. And so I swing, you know, from one end to the other.
Uh-huh.
If I remember, wait a second, down at the bottom of the ocean where my boat is anchored so firmly by my breath, down there, there is no wind. There is no praise or blame. Mm-mm. There is no fame or disrepute.
Mm-hmm.
We call that place, for lack of a better way of speaking about it, the ground of being. And I think of it as, when you were talking about insanity, think of the ground of being as the ground of sanity.
Okay, yeah.
It is the place where you go to reconnect to with yourself, where you go to recharge, where you go to remember there is nothing wrong with me. There is nothing missing. There's absolutely nothing lacking. There never was. There's nothing I have to fix. There's nothing I need to change. I am whole, perfect, and complete, just as I am.
Wow.
Now I'm going to go up to the surface where actually my life is happening.
Uh-huh.
And all sorts of people, including myself, are going to tell me what's wrong with me and what's good about me. And then I'm going to get, you know, wrapped up again.
Yeah.
And you can't avoid that because nobody can live in the bottom of the ocean.
No, you can't.
As I said before.
Yeah.
And so then the question is, how do you bring that knowledge, that strength, that stability, up to the surface so that you can use it?
Yeah.
Which is exactly what I was speaking about when I was speaking of bringing stillness into movement.
Uh-huh.
It's exactly the same thing. It's bringing the depth of the ocean into the surface waters so that I can navigate them better.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. Wow. So this idea of stillness and movement and like coming back to, well, let's see. What if you've had a pretty terrible day, like you're mentioning, and like, what would you recommend to being able to find that place of stillness or being able to connect to your anchor?
Well, it takes time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not going to happen like that. It's as if think of it this way.
Mm-hmm.
Our life is, let me say, grammatically correct. It's our lives. But you could say that the truth of things is that it's one life, you know, that we're all a part of. And it's this vast open field, wide clear sky. But because it's kind of scary to be out in the open like this, most of us live in this little closet. Mm-hmm. There's like this shed in the middle of the field. And it's dark and it's kind of damp and it's messy. And there's like, you know, broken brooms there and there's rakes and there's like, you know, all sorts of tools that we don't even know how to use. But it's kind of, you know, we're contained there and it mm-hmm. feels kind of safe mm-hmm. as if we were in this little cocoon. And so, and we don't know that right outside the door, there's this vast open field.
Yeah.
And so we just stay there and sometimes we feel really cramped. Sometimes we feel really overwhelmed because of all these things we have to do and we can't fit them all into this little shed.
Mm-hmm.
All we have to do is prop open the door a little bit, breathe the fresh air and realize, oh, there's a lot more space here. And then we might, you know, perhaps we peek out and then we get scared. It's like, no, it's too much. And then we come back in. But slowly over time, we realize, I don't want to live in a broom closet.
Yeah, but we're used to the broom closet, aren't we?
So how do I tolerate the discomfort of the
brightness, maybe?
The brightness, but also being afraid, right, of uncertainty. I mean, mm-hmm. we stay in familiar situations mm-hmm. that hurt us because they're familiar.
Wow. I think that deserves repeating. Can you say that one more time just because there was also a noise?
So we stay in familiar situations often when they're painful because they're familiar, right? We would rather stay with what we know than venture out into what we don't know.
Okay.
But what we don't know, that's the only place of possibility.
Yeah.
If we've already tried everything in our little broom closet, we have to venture out. And so to answer your question, you know, how does somebody get in touch with, you know, this sense of their wholeness or the sense of calm underneath the storm? First, you have to be willing to be a little uncomfortable.
Okay.
You have to be willing to get a little scared about not knowing what's going to happen next.
Yeah. Would you necessarily have to have a big enough catalyst to make you want to make that move? Like, would it have to be some sort of like a tragedy or a huge life transition? Like, how do you see? I mean, you've seen many, 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 many students over your time teaching. Would you say that oftentimes there's some sort of big catalyst, or sometimes it just someone opens their eyes?
I think it's all over. You know, there's a range of experiences. Often it does take something more dramatic for people to really turn and say, okay, I cannot keep living the way that I've been living.
Okay.
Because changing is uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Right. And I often say, you know, we don't do it until we absolutely have to. I mean, think of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
You don't think we're going to go back, to whatever extent we can, we're going to go back to live the way that we were living, even though so much of it doesn't work.
Right.
But we know it. And it's somewhat comfortable. The scaries, you know, of not knowing what things are going to be like, you know, for many of us it's too scary.
Yeah.
And so I have found that for many of us it does take a big shift. You know, somebody in their family dies, or they get diagnosed with an illness, or there's a rupture of some sort in their lives, and they realize, I don't have a choice. I have to change.
Right.
There are other people whose lives, you know, seem fine, but there's like this dissatisfaction. It's like, really, is this all there is?
Uh-huh.
Is this it? And so they might, you know, try, and they might try different things, you know, either different kinds of meditation, or they might try, you know, something that has a sense of not your usual 9-to-5 fare.
Yeah.
Because I think all of us understand on some level that there's more to life than working 9-to-5 and just making money and buying a house. And although, you know, all of those things are, they're perfectly fine.
Yeah.
But that's not why we're here.
Yeah.
Ultimately. And so why are we here?
Yeah.
And so some people ask themselves that question and they want to find out. And then they turn to some kind of spiritual practice.
Okay, right. So there are different possibilities within spiritual practices and with regard to Buddhism. Just like I remember being at the monastery and having a reference to one particular religion, but then also that person was in a Buddhist temple. So there is a possibility that you can be in a different spiritual faith, but still follow Buddhism, correct?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I mean, that's the nice thing about Buddhism, that it's because it doesn't take up the notion, the concept of God. If you believe in God, that's fine. If you don't believe in God, that's fine. And, you know, sometimes people say, well, right, Buddhism is not a religion. It's a way of life. It is a religion. I mean, it's the fourth largest religion in the world. So it's definitely a religion, but it's not a theistic religion.
Okay.
And so so I find that it lends itself very well, you know, to other paths. We've had people, you know, who are Christian ministers. We have certainly a lot of Jews come to Buddhism, Jubus.
Yeah, I think that's what I remember, like that phrase. Yeah. I was like, a Jubu, what's that? Oh, okay, you're in the Jewish faith, but you also are following Buddhism. Oh, that's okay. Oh, okay. I didn't know that at the time. I was like, oh, okay.
Sure. I mean, and the other religion may have a little bit more of a problem with it, but from Buddhism's perspective, not really. And you're also, you know, you can take up Buddhism to whatever extent you want. I mean, you can just practice meditation and decide that you don't really want to take up the whole framework of Buddhist teachings, but you really find meditation helps you. And that's perfectly fine. And people, in fact, have been doing that. And especially the last, I would say, 10 years, 15 years or so, mindfulness has become so popular.
Yes.
So there's also what people call secular Buddhism, where people really pick and choose the teachings that they want to use and study and the ones that they don't. And so, you know, there's no church, overall church in Buddhism. There's no Pope. And so I think part of what makes it so versatile is exactly that you have the option, you know, to really practice it in any way that you can. The danger, of course, is that it can get diluted, and it does. But I mean, you know, that's true of anything, really.
Yeah.
And so the person, you know, I think each person, you know, coming into a practice just needs to, you know, ask themselves, what is it that I'm really interested in, and then pursue that.
Yeah. I love the idea that there is a way out of suffering. Like, I think this is one of the things that sort of stands out to me. Like, number one, suffering exists. Oh, okay. Yes, we have to acknowledge that. And number two, you know, there is a way out, right? So the focal point on finding tools, right, to find a way to, I guess, deal with suffering, or maybe not. What is it? Someone said once, there's some things that are painful, right? But the suffering around that doesn't have to necessarily be equal, right? A lot of your state of mind and your choices that you make and how you see things can have a big difference.
Right. So there's that well-known quote, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional.
And you could say
that's what Buddhism rests on. The Buddha said all of these years, he taught for 40 some years, which is unusual for a spiritual teacher. And he said, all of my years of teaching, you can boil down to really one thing: suffering, the truth of suffering, and then how do you put an end to it?
There. I love that's also very simple but profound.
So that's what Buddhism is about. And it's basically saying, you know, I mean, I say this in my book, pain, because we're sentient beings, pain is inevitable. I mean, pain is the body's defense mechanism. In fact, people who don't experience pain often die young.
Okay.
Because they don't have a way, you know, to protect themselves. And so we want pain. Pain isn't bad by itself.
It's a red flag. It's letting you know something's happening. Please fix it.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
How we respond to pain is what brings about suffering or not.
Mm-hmm.
So in between the two, there's actually quite a bit of space. And if you think about it that way, is that then that's the space where practice happens, where zazen happens, where, you know, doing body practice or art practice can happen. Yeah. Pain is sometimes going to come up. Sometimes pleasure is going to come up and we're going to want to hold on to it.
Yeah.
But we can't. And so then we're going to start to suffer.
Yeah.
It's in that space, you know, to realize, oh, I don't have to follow pain with suffering. I don't have to. That's what the Buddha realized.
Yeah. That's a great choice. It's a great moment where you can make a choice about that.
And I feel that the first time that somebody experiences that, they're sitting in meditation and their knee hurts and we tell them how to work with pain. And the first time that they're really able to, in a sense, surrender to that pain, that it doesn't become a source of suffering. To me, that's the first time that they actually taste what the Buddha was talking about when he spoke about freedom. Because we spend our entire lives chasing after pleasure and avoiding pain. What if we didn't do that? What if we enjoyed pleasure when pleasure was there and let it go when it went away? What if we bore pain, were just with it when it
was
there, and were grateful when it goes away?
Oh, yeah.
But without chasing and holding on and pushing away, that's what creates the suffering, not the fact that pain and pleasure exist.
Right. And how exhausting is it to continually chase after things?
It's
over
exhausting.
And over again,
that's
right?
Why we're always exhausted.
Yeah.
Yes. And never ending.
And never ending, right? Yeah. I'm thinking about the points that you mentioned before: pain and pleasure, loss and gain, fame and disrepute, praise and blame. So just kind of looking at those points and, you know, just being with whatever comes up. Right. Enjoy the pleasure when it's there. If the pain is there, I think, you know, I used to teach prenatal yoga. And one of the things I often taught my prenatal yoga students was that fear would actually heighten their sensation of pain, right? So if they just paused and wouldn't go sort of in their kind of into fear mode, which then would they would just focus on like the inevitable, what they thought was going to be really bad pain, instead of actually focusing on what was really happening, which wasn't actually as bad as what their mind made it.
Exactly.
It's a big difference.
Exactly. And our aversion also, when we push away pain, it also makes it worse.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question, Zuise. If our listeners could have like a couple of tips that they could take away and apply today, what would you recommend?
Well, since we've spoken so much about the breath, I think I would return to that. You know, even if you're not ready to start a formal meditation practice, you can at any point come back to your breath, which, as one of my teachers once said, is like reclaiming your life. The moment you come back to your breath, you come back to yourself, you come back to this moment, you're reclaiming your life. And so, you know, before you sit down in front of your computer, you know, to start your workday, or for a moment or two before you serve the kids dinner, or as you're going out for a walk, at any point you can take a moment, take 3 breaths, let's say, and just ask yourself, you know, where am I right now? Like, where's my mind?
Perfect.
As a way of coming back, as a way of, as I said, returning to yourself. And it's such a simple practice. And because you always have your breath, you can always do it.
Yeah.
And when people say, oh, you know, I'm so busy, I don't have time to meditate. Well, there you go. I mean, this is going to take you, what, probably 10 seconds?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have time to do that.
You have time to do that. Definitely. That's fabulous. I love that. I love that. And another question. If our listeners wanted to find you, where could they find you?
Well, I'm on social media, although I'm very averse, speaking of aversion, I'm averse to social media. So I am active, I am active. So I'm on Instagram and Facebook, and that's it.
What's your handle on Instagram and Facebook? So that
Zuise Goddard.
I'll put it in the show notes too.
But really the best place I think is my website.
Yes.
So that is VanessaZuiseGoddard.org.
Okay. Excellent. Good. VanessaZuiseGoddard.org. That's excellent. And you have practices that students could join you for meditation online right now still too, right?
I do. Yes. So there's a Wednesday night that we're doing regularly that has meditation. And I usually, whether I do a talk or we do a discussion, actually one of my students gave a talk the other day.
Oh, beautiful.
So we speak of, you know, just different aspects of Buddhism and how to bring it into our lives. I'm about to start a study group, you know, on a Buddhist book. And then I, on occasion, will do retreats like on a Saturday or a Sunday. So all of that information is on my website.
Oh, I love that. That's such a gift. It's such a gift. I'm so excited that we've been able to have our conversations. We say, I would love it if you would come and speak to us again. Would you be up for that?
Well, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Excellent. Good, good, good. I'm so grateful for your presence and your focus and your groundedness and your gift that is, you know, the gift of peacefulness that I think you are helping so many students with. And I'm just so appreciative of that. And I thank you for being on the show. I look forward to seeing you again for another talk soon.
Well, I'm thankful, you know, that you invited me. I love speaking about stillness, especially in silence. I think it's such an important part of our lives. You know, people often think of meditation as a luxury. Oh, it's the thing that I do when I've done everything else and I go away on retreat or I go to a spa. And I really want to suggest that it is as important as eating or drinking or breathing.
Wow.
Because it is, in fact, what gives us the sanity and what gives us groundedness and what gives us clarity and the tools to be kind to one another. So I really think that it is not a luxury at all, but something that I think, you know, whether it's formal or not, again, I think is less important, you know, but a way for us to be still and silent with ourselves now and then. I don't know of anything more powerful, to be honest with you. So I really always relish every opportunity to share my experience of it and my thoughts on it. So thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much, Lucy. We look forward to seeing you again, hopefully soon.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Based on what we talked about, I made a special download for you entitled Introduction to Zazen. You can find this resource in the show notes or on my website, www.taylorfitwellness.com, on the resources page. Thanks. Have a great day, and we'll see you next time. Bye.